Blog Talk Radio.
Bring
Greetings, this is Abayomi Azikiwe, and welcome back to another edition of the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast. The Pan-African Journal is an audio news magazine. It's brought to you here on a weekly basis. I am your host, Abayomi Azikiwe, and later on in our program for today, which is August 21st, 2021, we'll be coming up with Pan-African Newswire report. We'll have dispatches on the rapid withdrawal, continuing rapid withdrawal of the United States Imperialist Forces and their allies from the capital of Kabul of Afghanistan. Algeria has stated that it will evaluate its diplomatic relations with neighboring Morocco related to the wave of forest fires which have erupted in the North African state. Zambia has elected a new president to lead the Southern African country. We'll have details on that. And the African National Congress of South Africa is holding a National Executive Committee meeting this weekend to discuss organizational issues. In the second and third hours, we will continue our month-long focus on Black August. We'll have a reexamination of the lifetimes and contributions of George L. Jackson. Today is the 50th anniversary of the martyrdom of George Jackson in the state of California at the San Quentin prison. George Jackson, a revolutionary student, writer, theoretician, field marshal of the Black Panther Party, was assassinated 50 years ago today by the California prison authorities. So these and other features will be brought to you during the course of our program. So stay tuned, and we'll take a musical interlude with the West African music of Tony Allen, the album entitled Black Voices. Let's listen in.
Duro de Asiko, Asiko. Duro de Asiko, Asiko. Duro de Asiko, Asiko. Duro de Asiko, Asiko. Ode bojule won we ki won ma fi ya je. Ode bojule won o we. Ode bojule won we ki won ma fi ya je. Ode bojule won o we.
got together.
Thank you.
less fisher than anyone. Discrimination, nothing we don't want to you. they party. Thank you. Shall we fool me?
Thank you. Black Aria, don't go.
Tony Allen from the West African state of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. And that album was entitled Black Voices. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal Worldwide Radio Broadcast for Saturday, August 21st, 2021. We're broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit. We'd like to thank all of our listeners for tuning in once again to yet another edition of our program. Right now we want to move into our Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And our lead story, of course, deals with the unfolding events due to the defeat of U.S. imperialism in Afghanistan. And, of course, we are covering this event on a daily basis at the Pan-African Newswire. According to a report from the Agence France-Presse, Taliban co-founder Mouly Abdul Ghani Baradar arrived in Kabul earlier today for talks on establishing a new inclusive government in Afghanistan. A senior official said other senior Taliban leaders seen in the capital in recent days include Khalili Haqqani, one of America's most wanted so-called terrorists with a $5 million bounty on his head. A pro-Taliban social media feed showed Haqqani meeting Gulbuddin Hekmat, a former bitter rival during the brutal civil war of the early 1990s, but still influential in Afghan politics. A senior Taliban official told the Agence France-Presse that Baradar would meet, quote, jihadi leaders and politicians for an inclusive government setup, unquote. Now, Baradar arrived in Afghanistan last Tuesday from Qatar, choosing to touch down in the country's second busy city of Kandahar, the Taliban's spiritual birthplace. Within hours of his return, the group announced his rule would be different this time. The Taliban have said they want this iteration of their government to be inclusive, but have given few details of it and who would be included. Arrested in Pakistan in 2010, Baradar was in custody until pressure from the United States saw him freed in 2018 and relocated in Qatar. He was appointed head of the Taliban's political office in Doha, where he oversaw the signing of the agreement that led to the withdrawal of U.S. forces after 20 years of directly occupying Afghanistan. The Taliban scouted any hopes of a negotiated peace deal with the Afghan government by overrunning the country in under 2 weeks, a lightning offensive that ended with them taking Kabul unopposed just less than a week ago on Sunday. on Friday, just one day ago, Khalil Haqqani, the uncle of Taliban deputy leader Sarojuddin Haqqani, was seen leading prayers at a mosque in Kabul. Another key leader of the so-called Haqqani network, Anas Haqqani, was also in the capital and had met former President Hamid Karzai and Abdullah Abdullah, who led the overall peace process for previous administration. And in the Republic of South Africa, in KwaZulu-Natal, the African National Congress chapter there said it was not involved in a planned shutdown poster that is circulating in Durban. The poster bearing the party logo states that there would be a shutdown protest headed to party provincial offices on Monday. The ANC said it was not consulted about the march or the use of its name and distanced itself from this. The ANC KZN's Inkla Nipo and Tombalela said the party was against the planned march and the poster. They said that, quote, we are putting on record that there is no march organized by the African National Congress in KwaZulu-Natal nor in the region and no other structures. As the ANC in KwaZulu-Natal has distanced itself from this march, the circulation of the poster comes as the province picks the pieces from the unrest in July. KwaZulu-Natal was the epicenter of violence and deadly looting that claimed over 300 lives. Since then, provincial authorities have been overwhelmed with pressure to rebuild broken social relations and public and private infrastructure amounting to over $45 billion. Earlier in the week, KZN Premier Sikle Sikalala said they were not taking reports about the posters lightly. Quote, we have reported these to law enforcement agencies, and we believe they are ready for that. We want to ensure the people of KZN that there is no such shutdown. We want to assure them and guarantee their safety that the police and other law enforcement agencies will be all over, unquote. You're listening to the Pan-African Newswire segment of the Pan-African Journal. And in the North African state of Algeria, the country will review its relations with the Kingdom of Morocco after accusing it of complicity in deadly forest fires, a presidency statement said on Wednesday, and the latest tension between the North African neighbors. At least 90 people, including 33 soldiers, were killed in dozens of forest fires that broke out amid a blistering heat wave on August the 9th across swaths of northern Algeria. Algerian President Abdelmadjid Tebboune has said most of the fires were criminal in origin. The decision to review relations with Rabat was made during an extraordinary meeting of the country's Security Council chaired by Tebboune and dedicated to evaluating the situation after the fires. The presidency statement said that the incessant hostile acts carried out by Morocco against Algeria have necessitated the review of relations between the two countries. It said there would also be an intensification of security controls on the western borders with Morocco. The border between Algeria and Morocco has been closed since 1994. The statement did not clarify what the review might mean. Algeria's DGSN security agency said investigations had discovered, quote, a criminal network classed as a terrorist organization, unquote, as being behind the fires, according to the, quote, admission of arrested members, unquote. Algerian authorities point the finger for the fires at the independence movement of the mainly Berber region of Kabylie, which extends along the Mediterranean coast east of the capital of Algiers. The authorities also accuse the Movement for Self-Determination of Kabylie of involvement in the lynching of a man falsely accused of arson, an incident that sparked outrage. The mob also set the victim on fire. Authorities have arrested 61 people over the incident. Some of the suspects have confessed to being members of the MAK, according to confessions broadcast on Algerian television. Algiers has also accused the Islamist-inspired Rashad movement of involvement as well. And finally, in Zambia, there is a new government slated to take office after the national presidential elections. A business tycoon and opposition leader, Hakainde Hichilema, was just this last past Monday declared winner of the hotly contested presidential elections in the Southern African state of Zambia, with 155 or 156 constituencies reporting. Official results showed Hichilema had captured a landslide of 2,810,757 votes against the 1,814,201 for President Edgar Lungu. Quote, "I therefore declare the said Hakainde Hichilema to be President-elect of the Republic of Zimbabwe of Zambia," unquote, Electoral Commission Chairman Justice Isao Shulu said in a televised address. The 59-year-old veteran opposition politician beat his longtime rival Lungu following a bruising race held against the backdrop of deteriorating standards of living. Lungu, who has been in office for 6 years, has tried to retain his mandate despite growing concerns about rising living costs and crackdown his economic degree and has promised to rebuild investor confidence in Zambia. We'll face an economy that has been racked by high debt, by inflation, and unemployment. In 2020, the copper-rich Southern African nation became the first country on the continent to default on its debt during the coronavirus pandemic. This is the sixth time Hichilema has run for the top job, and the third time he has challenged 64-year-old incumbent Lungu, who just nearly won their last contest 5 years ago in 2016. Shortly after results were declared, Hichilema tweeted a picture of himself filed with the caption, quote, "Thank you, Zambia," unquote. With that, we're going to conclude the Pan-African Newswire segment of our program. We'd like to remind our listeners that the Pan-African Newswire is an international electronic press service. It is designed to foster intelligent discussions on the affairs of African people throughout the continent and the world. The press agency was founded in January of 1998. Since then, it has published thousands upon thousands of articles and dispatches in numerous newspapers, magazines, journals, research reports, and on blogs and websites throughout the world. The Pan-African Newswire represents the only daily international news source on Pan-African and global affairs. If you'd like to log on to the Pan-African Newswire so you can stay abreast of some of the most pressing and burning issues of the day from Africa, from the African diaspora, and from the international community in general. All you have to do is go to our website, and that, of course, news.blogspot.com. That's panafricannews.blogspot.com. And if you'd like to have access to today's Pan-African Journal, this worldwide radio broadcast, all you need to do is go to the Pan-African Radio Network, and that's at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. That's blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. And we'll take a musical interlude, and we'll be back with our Black August commemorative programming with a special focus on George Jackson on the 50th anniversary of his martyrdom. We'll be back. Welcome back, and that was the voice of Thelma Houston. The tune entitled Don't Leave Me This Way, and you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, a worldwide radio broadcast. We're here broadcasting live from our studios in downtown Detroit, and today is Saturday, August 21st, 2021. And today represents the 50th anniversary of the martyrdom of George Lester Jackson, Jr., a revolutionary who was born in the United States in 1941 and was incarcerated in 1960, never to regain his freedom. He was politicized within the prison system during the 1960s and, of course, became a leader, an author, an organizer within the Black Guerrilla Family, the Black Panther Party, and the Black Liberation Movement in general. We're going to listen to a documentary entitled George Jackson, Day of the Gun. Let's listen in.
Good evening. I'm Belva Davis. Welcome to the world premiere of Day of the Gun. As a television journalist reporting on the explosive events of the 1970s, I saw firsthand the fierce and prolonged struggle which engulfed America and the Bay Area. I covered the free speech movement in Berkeley, the emergence of the Black Panther Party, the anger, protest, and riots of the anti-war movement. Those were dangerous and fearful times. One of the most brutal moments occurred at San Quentin Prison in August of 1971, when inmate, revolutionary George Jackson obtained a gun behind prison walls. The consequences were deadly. To this day, it remains a story filled with mystery and suspicion. Because tonight's special contains graphic pictures and descriptions of violent events, viewer discretion is advised. Now, Cron 4 presents Day of the Gun.
In spite of all, I am human and have done things that require forgiveness from others. I have transgressed against my fellows in moments of weakness and madness. I hope I can make it. George Jackson.
In the fall of 1970, George Jackson skyrocketed to international fame with the publication of his book, Soledad Brother, The Prison Letters of George Jackson. By the next year, he was dead.
George Jackson served a life sentence, which turned out to be a death sentence, for a $70 robbery.
The story of George Jackson is a story of the dark side of America. In August of 1971, when Jackson was a 29-year-old inmate at California's San Quentin Prison, he became the central figure in the prison's bloodiest day. Jackson obtained a gun, and in less than 30 minutes, a murderous rampage turned the adjustment center into a slaughterhouse. Six men, including Jackson, were killed.
It was unprecedented. It had never, ever happened before. It's never happened again.
During his prison life, George Jackson was a polarizing figure, hated as much as he was loved.
He was a threat in the prison system. He was one that just didn't seem to be very afraid.
He was defiant, he was proud, he was a revolutionary.
George Jackson was a thug. My guess is that he stole lunch money from his grade school associates.
He educated himself and emerged as the most powerful intellectual within the prison system.
He was a punk convict until he was catapulted into the spotlight. once in the limelight, I say he rose above punk convict, but I think he never rose above opportunist.
In the end, when George Jackson's cause had been lost and the cult of hero worship contaminated his heart and soul, Jackson sought comfort in a few loyal friends, Marx, Lenin, and Ho Chi Minh, the Vietnamese revolutionary who predicted, "When the prison gates fly open, the dragons will emerge." On a hot August day, with gun in hand, Jackson would tell the world just that.
We realize that we're shedding blood now. We're being killed.
The ascendancy of George Jackson came at a time when America's soul and its people were coming apart.
That this is revolution.
We will not be fooled.
The turbulent decades of the 1960s and 70s merged as one. The country's democratic institutions were severely challenged. Some advocated revolution.
I'm going to start right now to inform white people of what they don't know.
The black people in this country have been the victims of violence at the hands of the white man for 400 years.
American. We cannot survive if we go fight some yellow man in Vietnam who ain't never called us nigger.
There's nothing but a fool, child ass mother who doesn't give a when somebody is dying.
People had marched, people had gone to jail, people were very frustrated and very angry.
The unpopular war in Vietnam had become the longest and most divisive in American history. The bitter struggle for civil rights confirmed the failed promise of equality for all.
We'd been confined to the ghetto for years and years and years. We'd not been allowed to break out of the ghetto.
Riots turned American cities into burning embers. The political assassinations of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King Jr., and Robert Kennedy deepened the country's paranoia.
We were being put in a position of having to feel that our lives were under the gun.
Huey P. Newton and the Black Panther Party wanted justice beyond the streets of Oakland.
There were, I suppose, those who felt that all one needed to do was to take up the gun, and that that would be the path toward freedom.
The prisons of California had become a target for revolutionary change as well. The New Left viewed the growing convict population as symptomatic of the country's deeper social ills.
We've got the militant blacks, the militant Nazis, the militant Chicanos. They're all here under one roof, and we are sitting on this lid like a tea kettle waiting for the steam to either come up or the lid to blow off.
Inmates were championed as political prisoners, vanguards of the coming revolution, victims of their fascist capitalist oppressors.
As long as there is any political prisoner in this country, as long as anyone is being discriminated against, none of us are free.
When George Jackson emerged as the new god and leader of the left, those on the right saw him as the most powerful threat in the prison system.
I think racism is a control device, control mechanism, create an atmosphere whereby they can control inmates. And black is just a continuation of the same thing we've been going through on the street.
George Jackson was born in Chicago in 1941, one of five children in a poor working class family. His mother, Georgia, was afraid of what the streets could do to him.
She wouldn't let him go out and play. She kept him on the roof. You know, she wouldn't let him go out because she didn't want him to get in trouble.
I used to tell them that they were black, and in order to achieve, they'd have to be twice as good as white. I said, if you're twice as good as the white in school, then maybe you'll make something. Yes, that's what I used to tell them. It was the truth. So why hide it from them?
As a young boy at Catholic school, Jackson experienced racism. The playground was for white kids only. Growing up in the projects, he became involved in petty crime, fighting, stealing.
At age 15, his parents moved to L.A. and they settled in the Watts District, where he began to be involved in a little bit more serious crime, stealing a motorbike, breaking and entering. In 1958, he was convicted of a store burglary and sent to CYA, California Youth Authority camp, for several months. He escaped, fled back to Chicago, was involved in a knifing, came back to California in chains.
After spending time locked up in the California Youth Authority, Jackson graduated to state prison when he pled guilty to the robbery of a Bakersfield gas station. It was 1961. Jackson was 19 years old, and he received the indeterminate sentence of 1 year to life.
Well, I was incarcerated under a one to life, a term that calls for one to life, where I could have done 1 year and been released. I've done 10. That's more time than anybody in the state has ever done on a one to life.
According to fellow inmate James Carr, when the two became leaders of a gang known as the Wolfpack, much of their time was spent in the usual convict hustles: gambling, booze, sex, blackmail.
He knew how to play the game. He was a tough guy. He studied martial arts. He was, you know, he was strong, very muscular, very smart, very cunning guy.
Good behavior dictated Jackson's chance for parole. It became non-existent. Prison records indicate that he received over 40 disciplinary actions. Jackson spent 7 years in solitary.
He was a big guy. He was a tough guy. He was a predator when he was in the general population. He was a predator of other inmates. He just abused people.
He became a professional prisoner, a real dyed-in-the-wool convict.
And then he started reading revolutionary theory. Then he started reading Marx and Lenin and Mao, and he wrote, I read Marx and Lenin and Mao, and they redeemed me. All of a sudden, he had a context for his anger. He realized, you know, why he was there, why people of his race, of his working class background, why they were in prison in disproportionate numbers. And that was the appeal of George Jackson. He represented in the highest way the injustice of the system and the cruelty and the institutionalized racism of the system.
Coming up on Day of the Gun, inmate killings at Soledad Prison begins a chain of revenge and murder.
We now return to Cron 4 Presents Day of the Gun. This program contains graphic pictures and descriptions of violent events. Viewer discretion is advised.
We die too easily. We forgive and forget too easily. Gentle and refined people, aren't we? We'll make good communists if someone deals with the fascists for us.
In January of 1970, George Jackson was one of more than 2,000 inmates at Soledad Prison. Jackson had been here before. Located 100 miles south of San Francisco, the prison was in the heart of the fertile Salinas Valley, the salad bowl of America, the place where famed author John Steinbeck wrote eloquently of the dispossessed. When Soledad opened in 1951, it was the model for the California prison system, a showplace for reform. By the next decade, that hope had vanished.
Well, it was gladiator school. Of course, you had your gangs, you had your AB, Aryan Brotherhood, had your black, your BGF, your black guerrilla families, had the Mexican Mafia.
Soledad was a racist pit. It was a horrible, horrible place. I mean, the guards set the prisoners against each other. You know, there were conspiracies everywhere. There were stabbings. There were murders.
The guards were the enemy, the number one enemy, because they were killing both of us. And George was trying to explain this to a lot of guys. They couldn't get it to their heads.
Alan Mancino has spent much of his life behind bars, beginning as a teenager in the California Youth Authority. Like George Jackson, Mancino was from Los Angeles. Though the barrier of race allowed him to know Jackson only by reputation, the circumstance of their prison lives would crisscross in moments brutal and vicious, from Soledad to the tragedy at San Quentin.
The administration had him down as a troublemaker, as an instigator and agitator. He wasn't. He wasn't into the racial stuff. I'll say that about it.
I went through all the processes. I tried to get out. I went to school, program. But now on the side, I was studying. Things that I felt that would help the community.
George Jackson was a prisonized, tough, sometimes brutal prison gangster, and this prisonized toughness made him the best proselytizer for revolution on the yard.
At Soledad, the charismatic Jackson conducted secret political study groups with other inmates, trying to unify the prisoner class.
He was an internationalist. He identified with international communist solidarity.
And one of the projects he took on was that of transforming those who were behind bars to move away from what he called a criminal mentality to a revolutionary mentality.
And then he had the capabilities of mobilizing everybody. You know, if he said, hey, we're going to do this here, we do this here. And then when they saw this kind of power that could come from one person, naturally they feared that.
On the morning of January 13, 1970, a new exercise yard was opened at Soledad's notorious O-Wing. The prison grapevine had long predicted that a fight between black and white inmates would occur. Revenge was the motive because of the previous racial killings of blacks.
I would say the majority of people in Soledad knew that when the new exercise yard was open, that there would be a fight out there.
At around 9 a.m., a racially mixed group of inmates began entering the yard. W.L. Nolan, a prison boxing champion and Jackson's closest political ally, was among them.
We said, well, get on the court, basketball court, everyone pick your man. When everyone's set, then we'll do it.
The guard in the tower was O.G. Miller, white, 51 years old, known to be an expert with a rifle. Miller's background was similar to that of other guards. Ex-military, from a southern state, known to inmates as a racist.
He was going to shoot somebody black. If it was a fight out there on the yard or somewhere, he wasn't going to shoot his kind. He was going to shoot the other guy.
The fight started when Nolan threw the first punch at a white inmate. Others quickly joined the battle.
As soon as they started scuffling, shots rang out.
Without warning, Officer Miller fired his weapon at the inmates.
Nolan was the first one shot. He was shot through the chest on the first bullet off of a 30 caliber, very high-powered rifle. He was shot right in the heart.
It was straight up murder.
A second, then a third shot fired, hitting two other black inmates. Both would bleed to death. A white inmate had also been wounded.
And even Billy Harris, the one who really hated blacks, said that we thought we were just going to fight. Nobody really get killed. We get, you know, maybe some bruises and head bashing, but that'd be it.
3 days later, on January 16th, the Monterey County Grand Jury ruled the killings justifiable homicide.
There was just a thickness of anger and a sense of injustice that had occurred.
You just didn't kill us like that. And then dudes were saying, like, damn, we dying. Why are we dying by ourselves? And that was the attitude that everybody, you know.
Not long after the ruling had been announced, outrage turned into retribution. At around 6:30 p.m., 26-year-old guard John Mills was beaten and thrown from the top tier of Y Wing.
Absolutely in the wrong place at the wrong time.
A lot of people were glad. A lot of people were glad, white and black.
Mills was killed not because he was Mills, it was because he was a guard, to pay back for the Opie Miller shooting.
There was a note left on him. One down, two to go. That was stated really clearly.
According to prison authorities, there were inmates, black and white, who witnessed the killing of Officer Mills.
And the thing that killed me was them saying that they could hear Mills' keys jangling in the air as he fell, or was thrown from the third tier down to the bottom.
George Jackson, Fleeta Drumgo, and John Cluche became the primary suspects in the killing of Officer Mills. Cluche denied any involvement.
So you were not involved in the assault or killing of John Mills?
No.
Did you see anyone assault or kill John Mills?
No.
Do you know if George Jackson, in fact, killed John Mills?
No.
Jackson, however, was a marked man. According to Alan Mancino, prison guards took him to a secret meeting. They believed Mancino was an assassin for the Aryan Brotherhood.
They wanted me to take out George Jackson. They was going to open the cell up and open his cell up at the same time. And they wanted me to take him out. So I got word down to Jackson. That's the first time I'd never really talked to him. I never associated with him. I shot him a kite, I told him what was going on in the watch itself, that I wasn't going to do it.
A kite is prison slang for a letter.
Because I didn't want to kill him. I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to be involved in that. I had a grudging respect for the man. The way he conducted himself, and a lot of people hate him without reason.
In February, George Jackson, John Cluche, and Fleeta Drumgo were indicted for murder. Known as the Soledad Brothers, the case of the three inmates would become a cause celebre. John Mills was the first guard murdered at the prison. He left behind a wife and son.
Was the incident for which you're charged now, was it a revolutionary act on your part?
You asked me to confess to something?
Mm-hmm. Unless you want to. Did you kill the man?
Look, one of the most important elements of guerrilla warfare is maintain secrecy. I've killed nobody until it's been proven. And they'll never be able to prove anything like that.
Cron 4 presents Day of the Gun. This program contains graphic pictures and descriptions of violent events. Viewer discretion is advised.
Dearest Angela, I hope that by some means you have discovered that I love you deeply and would touch you tenderly, warmly, fiercely, if I could, if my enemies were not at present stronger.
Black militant Angela Davis was among the most impassioned who rallied to the cause of George Jackson.
George himself had become that symbol whom we absolutely had to save.
The first time I met him was on the occasion of one of the court appearances in Salinas, California.
Davis was one of four children, raised in a loving home by her school teacher parents in the racial hatred of Birmingham, Alabama. Acknowledged as a brilliant scholar, Davis studied Marxism and joined the Black Panthers. After a controversial fight, she was fired from her position as an assistant professor at UCLA for being a member of the Communist Party. It was during this time that Davis became involved with the Soledad Brothers Defense Committee and George Jackson.
At that time, I thought of him as emblematic of the oppression sustained by Black people. So few of them were in chains. It certainly evoked slavery.
Viewed by some as the glamour couple of the revolution, Davis and Jackson formed a close personal relationship, sharing the same vision for political change.
And it was, upon seeing him, very refreshing to realize that he was a human being, that he was, that he had joy in his heart.
Davis also became friends with the Jackson family and teenage brother Jonathan, who idolized George.
And I think came to imagine his own life as worth nothing if it could not be used to free his brother.
I have a young, courageous brother whom I love more than I love myself, but I have given him up to the revolution. I accept the possibility of his eventual death as I accept the responsibility of my own.
In the summer of 1970, Jonathan Jackson celebrated his 17th birthday. Friends at Jackson's Pasadena High School described him as warm, full of humor, never in trouble with the law. He also had an IQ of 117.
He just wanted to make sure that George was not kept in jail. He wanted to make sure that George was freed. He felt like that George had been done an injustice.
Jonathan would write, "I have one question to ask all of you. What would you do if it was your brother?"
Jonathan, being a young guy, and decided that, you know, he was going to get his brother out of prison by any means he could. And if it meant going there and taking hostages and exchanging hostages for his brother's freedom, he was willing to do that. And that was the plan.
On the morning of August 7th, 1970, at approximately 10:45 a.m., Jonathan Jackson walked into the Marin County courtroom of Judge Harold Haley. Within moments, Jonathan pulled out a pistol, carbine, and a 12-gauge shotgun. He announced that he was taking over, adding, "This is it. Everybody freeze." Weapons were given to inmates James McLean, William Christmas, and Rochelle McGee. As Judge Haley, Assistant District Attorney Gary Thomas, and three housewives who were serving as jurors were taken hostage, the gunman also stated, "We are the revolutionaries. The Soledad brothers must be freed." Taped under the neck of the 65-year-old judge was a shotgun.
As they got out here, then this other bushy-haired, light-haired one came out. He had the automatic weapon. And he came out, and about this time, the one that had the gun on Judge Haley turned around and saw me. And he says, "Kill that mother." He says, "Kill him, kill him, kill him."
Jonathan and his fellow gunmen led the hostages to a van in the parking lot of the Civic Center.
By that time, the van was surrounded by various law enforcement people, including guards from San Quentin, who just happened to be nearby practicing shooting.
The guards' prison training included the no hostage rule. It meant negotiating for hostages would not happen. With Jonathan Jackson behind the wheel of the van, its human cargo was driving straight into the path of a San Quentin sergeant.
He did not have radio contact with the sheriff or anybody else. He did not know that the sheriff of Marin County had said, "Let the van go." So he told his officers to fire.
So the other two really fired the first shot and hit Jonathan first. And a lot of the shooting inside the van was done by the assistant district attorney at the time, Gary Thomas. When one of the convicts went down, the gun fell on the floor, he picked it up and started firing, killing the other inmates inside.
When the gunfire ended, Jonathan Jackson, William Christmas, and James McLean were dead. Rochelle McGee was wounded, as was one of the female jurors. Assistant DA Gary Thomas suffered a gunshot to his spinal cord and would be paralyzed from the waist down for life. In the frenzy of violence, the shotgun under the neck of Judge Harold Haley was triggered, killing him.
When a shotgun goes off in someone's face, you can imagine how the kind of destruction and the gruesome effect of that. And so it was quite a shocking scene.
I'm saying that there was no conspiracy, that Johnson, 17-year-old man-child, was working according to the dictates of his own mind.
George Jackson would later declare that he was proud of his brother Jonathan's military action, adding, he was the true revolutionary, the black communist guerrilla in the highest state of development.
I'd be the last one to say that Johnson had suicide in mind. I'm certain that Johnson felt that the police would have some concern, would give some concern to the lives of those five civilians. I'm thinking that Johnson was trying to demonstrate to the public, to the people, just how he felt that these problems should be solved.
I think that he was led to believe that it was possible, even by George himself. I think George encouraged this. I think George put him up to it.
It's very tragic that he died at such a young age. I don't think many of us realize how exclusively focused he was on George.
Nobody knows what he was thinking except Jonathan. But I think he did it for love of his brother and his country. He was trying to wake the people in this country up to the fact that black people had nothing.
Because some of the weapons used by Jonathan Jackson were bought and registered by Angela Davis, law enforcement officials believed Davis was a co-conspirator. Davis fled and became a fugitive from justice, the object of a nationwide manhunt by the FBI. Her wanted poster listed charges of murder, kidnapping, and conspiracy.
Well, I left because I did not think there was any possibility of justice. I didn't have any choice. It wasn't something I wanted to do. It was something I had to do.
You're driven by fear.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
2 months later, the 26-year-old Davis was arrested in a New York City motel. After her return to California, she was taken to the Marin County Jail and locked up one floor above the courtroom where Jonathan Jackson had taken the hostages.
The Jonathan Jackson thing put us on the alert to specifically reinforced our belief that there are people out there, radicals out there, willing to do most anything in order to make their point or to free George Jackson.
The real fatal irony of the Marin County courthouse shootout is that after Jonathan's death, George Jackson's death becomes inevitable. George Jackson had to transform himself finally into the dragon, the shaman, the priest, the convict of revenge.
Coming up on Day of the Gun, George Jackson wants...
We now return to Cron 4 Presents Day of the Gun. Viewer discretion is advised.
Dear Mama, I'm going to night school again and have encountered no trouble of late. They say today is Mother's Day. I can't make much sense of it, though. I love mine every day.
Welcome back, and that was excerpts from a fascinating documentary entitled Day of the Gun, focusing on George Jackson. And you're listening to the Pan-African Journal, the worldwide radio broadcast, and we're here on Saturday, August the 21st, 2021. The 50th anniversary of the assassination of George Jackson. And, of course, we'll take a break. We'll be back with more of our program for this week. Welcome back, and that was Funkadelic, and you and your folk, me and my folk, And right now we want to move into a focus on Robert F. Williams, a continuation of our Black Caucus recognition for 2021. This is a rare archived interview of Robert Williams in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, being interviewed in 1968.
Franklin Williams, the president in exile of the New Republic of Africa, recently formed in the United States. Rob Williams is a U.S. citizen who left the United States in 1961, pursued by the FBI and the police of the state of North Carolina. He lived in Cuba from 1961 to 1966, broadcasting to the United States on his own radio program, Radio Free Dixie, and sending in copies of his monthly newsletter, The Crusader. Since 1966, he's been resident in Peking, China, where he has continued sending his newsletter, The Crusader, into the United States. Rob is considered one of the best-known leaders of the Black Nationalist Movement.
Rob, I notice you're wearing a button of the of Chairman Mao Zedong.
Yes, I got it in Peking because the Cultural Revolution is going on there, and that I'm being supported by the Chinese people, so naturally I would support the Chinese people in their Cultural Revolution.
Well, I'd like to start this interview. I think a lot of our viewers, people in the United States, many may be familiar with the circumstances under which Robert Franklin Williams left the United States in 1961. You were a fugitive at that time. You were under, there was a warrant out for your arrest for kidnapping in the state of North Carolina, and I believe also for interstate flight by the Federal Bureau of Investigation. Could you tell us very briefly what led to those things? Do you think there was any base for the charges, and are they still pending against you?
Yeah, well, according to their concept, I was a fugitive. But according to my concept, I was a refugee. A refugee from racial oppression, but this case grew out of the fact that I had for many years fought against racial tyranny in the South, that I had fought against racial segregation, racial discrimination, and racial dehumanization, and I became an enemy of the power structure. And because of this, I became also an object of hatred on the part of the local power structure. And the local power structure, through manipulation, because a local Klan lawyer was also Kennedy's White House aide, they were able to manipulate Washington. And
oh, just 1 second now. This happened in 1961 in August. At that time, you were head of the Union County branch of the NAACP.
Yes.
There were some freedom riders that had come to your city of Monroe.
Yes.
Right? And you had organized what you called a guard or self-defense force. What was this guard?
Yes, well, the Freedom Riders came for a different purpose. We had a standing guard there to defend the black community against white aggression. And this white aggression was primarily on the part of the Ku Klux Klan, backed up by the local racist police. The Freedom Riders came in to help assist and nonviolent demonstrations. These demonstrations were being conducted for the abolition of police brutality, the abolition of Jim Crow, of Jim Crow facilities, and we had a 10-point program wherein we had asked for fair employment. And
Now, but you weren't, the Freedom Riders were nonviolent demonstrators.
Yes.
At this, you were not participating, though, in their demonstration, as I understand it, guard, your people.
No, I refused to participate in these demonstrations on the grounds that I would not pledge myself to nonviolence, because I believed, and I've always believed, in self-defense. But I did ask the people, and they accepted reluctantly the idea that they would support these nonviolent demonstrations for a trial, because this was to be a trial to see if we had been in error with our self-defense policy and to see if nonviolence really had the power of persuasion against these white terrorists.
Now, this guard, though, that you had consisted of about 200 or 300 people who were armed. You had set up foxholes, defense things, and so on. Were you advocating violence then, or was this strictly a self-defense thing for your black community?
Well, I advocated violent self-defense, because I don't think you can really have a defense against violent racists and against terrorists unless you're prepared to meet violence with violence. And my policy was to meet violence with violence.
Oh, would you say that your policy was to fire only when fired upon, or were you going to go out and attack people who you didn't like?
Well, it is commonly known that trenches and foxholes are fixed positions, and these are fixed positions of defense, and this is what we had. But the idea was to protect our communities, because law had broken down and the police had refused to protect us, so there was nothing else for men who had self-respect as men to do but to protect their families and their homes.
Now, in this situation of Klan violence, of you setting up foxholes and trenches and so on and arming your neighborhood, what specific event led to this charge against you of kidnapping?
Well, actually, in August, we had some violent attacks on pacifist demonstrators. And on August the 28th, on Sunday afternoon, that the Klan had recruited or solicited support from as far away as Georgia, from Georgia and South Carolina, thousands of Klansmen, Minutemen, and other fascist and racist poured into the city. And they had said that they were going to crush this demonstration and that they were going to destroy our branch of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, and most of all, that they were going to kill me and to destroy our branch of the NAACP. So we had an armed guard, and we had been arming people for quite a while throughout the community. So we prepared to defend ourselves. Also, the Klan had made forays and attacks into our community. They had stoned people. They had thrown missiles from cars, and had 14 women had been struck by these objects. And we were prepared to defend the community.
What specifically was the kidnapping charge based upon?
Charge was based upon the fact that some white racists who had been riding around and agitating, and they had had a banner on their car the previous day stating that this was open season on coons, that they had come into a community where many of the people had relatives who had been imprisoned and beaten openly on the streets of Monroe, and these people had come into this community, and these angry people who were about a half a block from my house had taken these people out of a car, and that they had brought them up the block in front of my house, and they had called for me to come out. When I came out, they were threatening to kill them, and these were not people who were members of our guard. These were groups of people roaming the streets who had become angry, and these were people who were not under the discipline of our God. And so the fact was that I had to come out of the house, and these people were, some were screaming and crying to kill these people, that they were calling them white beasts, and that they were had been responsible for Ku Klux Klan activity, that they should be killed. And I knew that with the tension as high as it was, that they would have been killed. So the crowd was gradually closing in on them. I had to come out. I came down my steps off the porch into the yard, and I started to force the crowd away from them so that they would be arm's length away, because I knew if one person in that crowd struck out at them, that crowd was so angry it would have torn them apart. So
now, just a minute. Now, you had not told anybody to take anyone out of the car. In fact, you didn't know it had happened until the crowd brought these people in front of your house.
No, well, this was a different crowd. The guard that we had, this guard was under orders, and this guard had been pulled back into a rear area waiting for a showdown with the main force of the Klan.
But you didn't tell anyone, you didn't order anyone to take those two people out of their car.
No, there was no need to order anyone to take anyone out of a car. But first thing, we didn't have any facilities for taking anybody. Next thing, if there were enemies enough for any action to be taken, the idea was to use violence against them. But these people didn't use violence at this time. They only wanted to kill these people. And the only reason they didn't kill them was the fact that this woman, Mrs. Stegall, was in the car, because previous cars had passed through and they had been fired on. That I saw groups of men fire M1 rifles and 30 caliber rifles, Italian carbines, and they had tracer bullets, and I saw these bullets penetrating these cars. But in this case, because this woman was in this car, instead of firing on the car, that some of the people just took her out of the car and took this man out, and there was some question, some difference among the crowd as to what must be done.
But now, what did you have to do with
all
this?
Well, I didn't have anything to do with it, because it occurred a half block from my house, and I was in the house at that time taking care of telephone calls that were coming in from many parts of the county and all over the city of people who wanted to know what had happened to their children who were on the picket lines, and also of people volunteering to join the Guard, and they wanted to come in to fight and make an all-out war and a showdown. But
Now, these two people were taken into your house, however.
No, they weren't taken into my house. When I came out into the yard, the woman, Mrs. Stegall, said that we have been kidnapped. And I said, well, here, lady, you're not kidnapped. You're free to leave anytime you get ready. And she said, well, if you will take us out, that we will be safe. These people will let us go if you will escort us out of this block. And I told her, no, lady, I'm not going to take you out of here, because I didn't bring you here, and I'm not going to take you out. And you're free to leave whenever you get ready.
Well, were you guilty of kidnapping? Did you physically kidnap or force these people to leave their car or enter your house?
They were taken out of the car by a group of people in the streets, and they followed me into my house. They had asked me to take them out of the community, and I refused to do it. So when I turned to go into the house to answer the telephone, they followed me.
Were they afraid? Was that why they followed you into the house?
Yes, they were afraid of the group of angry people, and these people were screaming that they should be killed, and I'm sure they would have killed them if they had stayed there.
So by following you into your house, they felt they'd be safer than out with a crowd. Now, did you make them stay in your house?
No, I didn't make them stay there. In fact, they wanted to stay because they had voluntarily followed me into the house, and they stayed there because they knew that that group in the streets, in the street, would have really killed them.
So you personally feel that the charge that you kidnapped anybody or caused them to be kidnapped is unjust. Is that your position?
Yeah, well, it's not that I feel that. I know that. I'm certain of this.
Now, so why is it that you then fled Monroe that night?
Well, the idea was to flee Monroe because there was no justice there, that I was leaving Monroe so that I wouldn't be in the community, because we thought it was going to be a big showdown and a lot of people would be killed, and they knew that I was going to be blamed for everything there. So the local people said that I should go away for a week or two until it was over and return.
Now, did you feel that your life was threatened? Is that why you left, or why?
Well, I felt my life was threatened, but that wasn't why I left. The idea was that I wouldn't be on the scene, and that they wouldn't be able to frame me, that anything that would happen, I wouldn't be held responsible, because it would be known that I was not in the community at the time.
Now, what happened to these two people that were in your house? Were they still there when you left, or had they been freed?
They were still there when I left, and according to the papers, when they left, they just left themselves, and they left free.
Were they harmed or what?
Well, according to the testimony of the people themselves, they were not harmed.
So, but you feel that this, that was the charge against you, that you had caused them to, you and May Mallory and these other people had caused them to be taken out of their car and into your house, and this constituted kidnapping?
Well, this was their charge, but the fact is that none of the people who stopped them in the streets were indicted. That they only indicted the people they wanted to indict, and they weren't interested in any of the people. About 200 or 300 people stopped them, according to their own admission. But none of the people who were indicted were in the group that stopped them.
Now, who were the people who were indicted? I mean, what type of people were they? Why were they indicted?
Well, one was a white freedom rider from New York, John Lowry. Mae Mallory was a housewife, a mother of two children, and two local fellows, Harold Reap and James Crowder. And these people were actually students. They were youth. And they were also youth leaders. So the idea was not to punish anybody for a kidnap, not to punish anybody who had stopped these people, but they had certain people they wanted to get rid of in the community.
Now, what has happened to the other people, the ones that stayed in the United States, who were indicted on that kidnapping charge?
Well, they are living normal lives in New York. That John Lowry is working in a bank, and I understand that he is now a junior bank official. Mae Mallory is working in a hospital and is traveling freely. In fact, she's just recently been here, and she was issued a passport to come here. That the other two youths are also living in New York, and the trial has not, since it was thrown out by the Supreme Court of North Carolina on the ground of racial discrimination and jury selection, it has not been recalled.
So in other words, the original charge against you, the people who were indicted, who were captured, their conviction was thrown out by the North Carolina State Supreme Court, and they are presently, what, under indictment or what?
Yes, the conviction was thrown out, but they were re-indicted. And this is more of a threat, a form of intimidation, than an active case, because they were re-indicted, but none of them have been picked up to be returned to the state of North Carolina.
So is it your feeling the state of North Carolina is not going to try to press this case?
Well, evidently not, because they didn't press it up until this time, and they seem to be only interested in me.
And this whole thing happened now more than 7 years ago.
Yes, more than 7 years ago.
So now, you fled, however. I heard that you were told that the sheriff was going to hang you or your body was going to be in the town square or something, that there was they were directly threatening to kill you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, this was the chief of police, who said that in 30 minutes state troopers were already coming to town, and that in 30 minutes I would be hanging up in the courthouse square.
Well, now, to make, I know it was a very complicated story, but in essence, you left Monroe, you got to New York and found out there was a federal warrant for your arrest for leaving the state of North Carolina.
Yes.
And you subsequently went to Canada as a fugitive.
Yes.
And then through a roundabout means through California and Mexico, got to Cuba.
Yes.
Now, you were in Cuba from 1961 up until 1966.
Yes.
Well, why Cuba of all places? Why to a communist country so you could be accused of being a pro-communist propagandist instead of a real Afro-American freedom fighter just working for equality of the American Negro people? I mean, why to Cuba?
I was given political asylum in Cuba. And I was there as an exile in Cuba, and I lived there as an exile.
Now, were there any particular Cuban leaders who gave you this asylum, or was it just, in general, the government there?
Well, actually, this political exile was given to me under the direct orders of Fidel Castro himself.
Why did he do this?
Well, he did this because, first thing, I had been a friend of Cuba. I had visited there on two occasions before, and the fact that the Cubans were convinced that under the racist laws in the United States, especially in the South, that it would be impossible for a black person to obtain justice. So they gave me this on the grounds that I couldn't get justice in a racist country.
Now, do you feel that the Cubans were using you to make propaganda against the United States?
No, I don't think they were deliberately using me, because there was some division in Cuba as to whether or not I should be allowed to enter there. And it so happened that Fidel himself took the position that I should be. And actually, he had to go against some of the party officials to reach this conclusion. So it wasn't a matter of just allowing me to be there on the grounds of propaganda.
Now, you say he had to go against some of the... You mean that the Communist Party of Cuba opposed your coming to Cuba?
Well, not the Communist Party as a whole, but some of the members in the party some of the other people in Cuba, and also those who had close connections with the U.S. Communist Party, because the U.S. Communist Party was opposed to my going to Cuba, and they tried to use their influence in Cuba to prevent my entrance into Cuba.
Why was the U.S. Communist Party, why do you feel they were opposed to you going to Cuba?
Well, the first thing was that I didn't belong to the U.S. Communist Party, and I was considered a black nationalist, and they opposed black nationalism. So they didn't want me in Cuba because they felt that they could no longer speak for the black people in America if they really had a genuine black person from the movement who had been in struggle. And this would have taken away some of their authority in Cuba. So they didn't want me there because they felt it would be a conflict between my black nationalism and their class theory.
Now, excuse me. Now, the arrival in Cuba, your arrival in Cuba, gave you certain facilities. That is to say, the Cuban government permitted you and helped you in publishing your newsletter, The Crusader, and also in making radio broadcasts to the United States on your radio station that was called Radio Free Dixie. Do you feel that giving you these facilities was more than just asylum, but in fact was helping you make propaganda for black nationalism?
Well, I said it was because the Cubans had made it plain that they support the liberation struggles of the peoples of the world, and they considered our struggle no exception. And the fact was that I had asked for this time and this program, and some of the party officials did not approve of it, and it was necessary for Fidel himself to intervene in this. And some of the party officials felt that I should be under the regular Cuban party propaganda. But Fidel Castro took the position that I was a freedom fighter from the United States, and that as a black American, that I knew more about what the propaganda should be than anybody. So his position was to leave him alone and to let him determine what he should do.
Now, while you were in Cuba, your wife, Mabel, and your two boys managed to get to Cuba from the United States, and they lived there with you.
Yes.
You had your own house there in Cuba, furnished
yes.
by the Cuban government. Now, did you ever feel that what you were doing was in any way an act of treason or unpatriotism towards your country, towards the United States of America, or had you abandoned America? Did you feel you were now a Cuban, or what?
Now, I don't believe any man who lives under tyranny in a government can ever be truthfully accused of treason. Treason can only come when a man is entitled to the rights and privileges and he is protected by his government, and then he betrays that government, then he can be accused of treason. But when the government betrays its trust to its people, then the government is what is guilty, is the guilty party to treason. And I consider the government of the United States to have failed the black people in America in protecting the rights of black people in the enforcement of the Constitution. So it wasn't a matter of treason, but it was a matter of constitutional betrayal on the part of the United States of America, on the part of the government and the so-called decent people in America.
This is The Crusader. This was your monthly newsletter from Cuba. It's the issue of May, June 64. I mean, there's a cartoon here. Afro-American revolt, the racist USA, the torch of retribution. Now, we see what appears to be an Afro-American lighting fire to buildings. Now, if you were going to put out something of this kind, don't you think that it would have been better to do it in a neutral country so that people couldn't say, well, this is just anti-U.S. communist propaganda coming from Cuba, that you've been a tool of the Cubans?
Neutral country? As far as the black man is concerned, there's no such thing as a neutral country in the world. Either a country is for justice, either a country is for the liberation of the oppressed, or that it is against it. That there's no such thing as neutrality under justice. That either you've got to be for justice or against it. Now, as a black man in America, I went to the countries that would accept me. Now, since I've been in Cuba and China, I've tried to go to France, I've tried to go to Sweden. I expected Sweden to be a neutral country. I expected France to be a neutral country, but I discovered that they're not neutral, that they're with the United States government. I was in Canada. I had hoped to stay in Canada. I had been there for a month. But then I discovered that the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had entered the search for me, and that the response of the United States government was seeking to return me to the racist United States.
But even though the Royal Canadian Mounted Police had entered the search for you, and later on you couldn't get into France and Sweden and places like that, why did you feel it necessary to send out something that was that is so obviously inflammatory and an agitational pamphlet? Didn't you realize that by it coming from Cuba, even though you were publishing it yourself, that people in the United States would say this is just anti-U.S. communist propaganda? They wouldn't read what was in it.
But it makes no difference what the people in the United States say. If they were concerned with justice, they would be speaking out against the racial injustice there, and it wouldn't be necessary to publish such publications as this. The fact is that I belong to an oppressed group, an oppressed class, an oppressed race, and it is my duty to agitate for the liberation of these people, for the freedom of our people, no matter what the enemy may say, no matter what impression I may give. Now, Cuba was a place that I could freely work, and a person who is truly interested in justice must work from wherever he can. So I worked from Cuba.
So you do not feel that your publications in any way caused the Watts or Detroit or Newark riots?
No, I feel that Washington and the American people, the apathy of the American people, at least those in the power structure, actually responsible for these riots. No, that I'm a victim of those same conditions. So it is the duty that I'm duty bound to oppose this any way that I can, by any means necessary, and to advocate a policy of the elimination of these conditions. And I don't care what the cost is or what method I must use. And I'm happy to know if this method is proven successful, then I'm happy. I feel happy about it that I am accomplishing my objective.
Well, getting back to Cuba, what were conditions like for you in Cuba? You had a long interview with Che Guevara before he left Cuba, just shortly before he vanished. Why did you leave Cuba? There have been stories that you felt threatened in Cuba, that you had serious problems after being in Cuba almost 5 years. Why did you leave there? What was your situation? What did Guevara have to say to you, and why did you leave?
Well, I didn't feel threatened in Cuba. Fact was that I wasn't being as effective in Cuba as I had been, as I felt that I could be. Fact was that the Cuban government, or some faction in the government, had started to sabotage my work, and I discovered that they weren't really interested in the elimination of these oppressive conditions in the United States, that they wanted to create an image as revolutionaries, but they didn't want to do anything. They didn't want me to do anything, that they just wanted to support me there, or pretend to support me, without really taking any concrete steps, and they did everything they could to keep me from promoting black nationalism and an effective struggle for our people. So I left.
Yeah, but they did give you radio broadcast facilities and facilities for publishing and getting, what, about 40,000 of these things a month into the States. How were they sabotaging you?
Yeah, well, in the beginning they had helped me, but actually it wasn't the government that started to print these publications. Actually, the Cuban workers, the printers, agreed to do this, and these publications were being printed before the government even realized it. And they were even being sent into the States. But then after the government realized it, that the government did start to support this, because they saw it as a good propaganda thing. But the thing about it is the government tried more and more to patch up some differences with the United States government. More and more they started putting pressure on me. They started sabotaging. And they didn't sabotage my life there. And they supported me up until the end as an individual, but they didn't want to do anything that would rouse the antagonism of the United States government.
Now, just a minute. You think that you say that the Cuban government was trying not to antagonize the U.S. government? Why was that?
Yes, they were trying not to do this. Evidently, they were trying to reach some agreement on the exiles in the United States, the Cuban exiles. And
you mean to keep the exiles from attacking Cuba, they would stop you from attacking the United States?
That's what actually the United States government had already started intervening, and they had started restraining the Cuban exiles in the United States. So I suppose, it's just my assumption, I don't have any concrete evidence, but I assume that this was reciprocal and that the Cuban government also started restraining me.
Well, what about your relationships with Che Guevara? Did he sponsor you? In other words, were you doing what he thought should be done, like starting one, two, many Vietnams, whatever his slogan was?
Well, I had had a long discussion with Che on the eve before his disappearance, and he had said that they had some differences in the government. He had said that he differed with them, and he thought that I should receive more support from the Cuban government, and that the Afro-Americans in the United States should receive more support.
Now, what was his difference with the other people in the Cuban government?
Well, according to what he had stated, was the difference in the revolutionary belief. The fact that he believed in a revolution, he believed that Cuba should support the revolutionary movements, and that more and more the Cuban government was not supporting the revolutionary movements. So this was his difference, basically.
Now, when you say support the revolutionary movements, do you consider the movement for equality for American Negroes to be a revolutionary movement?
Yes, well, it's developing into a revolutionary movement, and the fact was that we could see this potential. And everybody knows that that there can be no political freedom or economic freedom for the black people in America without revolutionary conditions or without revolutionary activity.
Well, now here, in your Crusader newsletter, you started out with this letterhead, this man, medieval crusader on horseback. However, you've changed it in the last couple of years to the machine gun and the torch. Now, I get the impression from this, and many people do, that when you say revolution, you mean violence, you mean arson, you mean destruction. You just don't mean a change in the American way of life.
Well, this change took place because of changing times. That when I first started with the Crusader Man on Horse, those were different conditions. That they were the conditions of people who believed in Gandhi, people who believed in Christianity. And these boycotts and demonstrations were led by a lot of church people.
Martin Luther King and so on.
Yes. And so we believed in that. But this is a matter of evolution, that I didn't decide to change this man's head myself. But many people wrote in, many of the black people in the black communities who were distributing this, and they said that they didn't think this was an appropriate symbol for the new movement, for the new mood. And so this is why we adapted this new masthead with the machine gun and the torch.
Yeah, and this was, but you changed this after what? That is to say, after 1965 was when you changed it.
Yes, because this was the new era of the bullet, of the fire and the bullet. So it was time to change. This was no longer just a religious or philosophical crusade, but this was a new era that had entered the stage of history.
Now, when you say new era, you mean that you arbitrarily decided that the bullet and the arson's torch, the Molotov cocktail, that this was going to be the way you were going to express yourself?
No, the people in the streets decided this. And they wrote to me, and they suggested, and some even demanded, that I get in step with this new tendency, because it had come, and they knew that I was with it, but they didn't think that this was giving the right image, this masthead, so I changed it.
Now, when you left Cuba, was there any particular incident that forced you to leave Cuba? Were there any particular individuals who forced you to leave Cuba?
There were many incidents and some certain individuals, because the Cuban people always supported me, the revolutionaries supported me, the military men supported me, but there were a few people, a few leaders around Fidel, like Comandante Vallejo, Comandante Piñera, and Osmani Cienfuegos. These people had tried to sabotage the Afro-American struggle, and they were pretending to be party people and pretending to be great leftists and Marxist-Leninists, but all the time they were sabotaging what I was doing and doing everything to make my struggle ineffective and my stay uncomfortable in Cuba.
Now, when you say sabotaging, there has to be a reason for this. If you think they were trying to sabotage your work, your radio broadcast, your publishing of your newsletter, why do you think they were doing this?
I think they were doing it because there had been some infiltration into the Cuban intelligence, and Piñera was also one of the intelligence officials, and he was either being misled, being fed misinformation, he was working directly for the United States and for the CIA.
You think that, the CIA was that deep into the Cuban government that they could surround the people, touch the people surrounding Fidel and actually stop what you were doing when he wanted it done?
Well, I don't think that. I know that because I had close contact with them and I know what they were able to do.
I mean, do you think the CIA did this or was it someone else? Do you think maybe the Russians did it?
Well, it appears that the CIA did it because all that was done was pro-American, and it would have benefited America more than anybody else or any other country. But it could be that it was a joint operation, or it could have been some other country. But I know that it was done because I was the victim of it.
So their specific actions caused you to believe that you must, that you had to leave Cuba.
Well, if I wanted to carry on my struggle for the liberation of the black people in America, if I could live true to what I believed, I had to leave Cuba. But I wasn't forced out of Cuba, that I had a choice of remaining there. But I could have remained in Cuba as a socialist Uncle Tom. But I didn't see any difference in being a socialist Uncle Tom than in being an Uncle Tom in capitalist and racist America. And I'm not cut out to be an Uncle Tom, no matter who is for.
Now, why did you go to China, to the mainland of China, what we call communist China in the States? Why didn't you go to a neutral country at this time?
Well, I had tried to go to Sweden. I tried to go to Sweden from Cuba. I tried to go to Canada. I applied for a visa. I applied to immigration, the Canadian immigration. I filled out a form, and they rejected me. There was no place else to go but China. So the Chinese people and the Chinese government received me with open arms, and I'm grateful to them for this. And I would also always be grateful to them. But where else could a black freedom fighter go in the world but to the People's Republic of China?
Now, when you arrived in China, this was in 1966, did the Chinese offer you facilities such as propaganda facilities, broadcast facilities, newspaper facilities? In other words, were you able to keep putting out the things that you've been doing in Cuba?
Yes, that I had the opportunity to do what I was doing in Cuba and more. That the Chinese only stated that they supported me and they supported the black people in America, and that I should ask them what I wanted to do, should tell them. And if I had any special requests, all I had to do was to make these requests. And this was the position of the Chinese government, this was the position of the Chinese people, that they didn't take any active part in this, but they left it up to me as a matter of principle, the principle that they support revolutionary people and struggling peoples in the world.
Now, are you working for the communist Chinese government? Are you their agent or a spokesman for them today?
No, I've never been a spokesman, I've never been an agent, and I've never been on their payroll. I live in China as an exile. They have given me political asylum as an exile. They support my struggle. They never dictate any policy to me, and my propaganda is completely divorced from theirs. And anybody who studies the situation closely can see that there is some difference in my propaganda and Chinese propaganda. And the Chinese allow me to produce my propaganda without interference. And they have never asked me to change my way of thinking. They've never tried to pressure me into making any decision that I didn't want to make.
Yet you wear a Mao Zedong button. This would indicate that you have accepted the philosophy of Chairman Mao and that you are a supporter of it.
Yes, that I believe that he has done a lot of good for China, that he's brought the Chinese people a great distance in a short length of time. He is one of the great leaders of history, and that Chairman Mao means something to more than just communists in the world, that he is also a defender of the rights of the poor, of the oppressed.
Now, do you mean by that Afro-Americans, that American Negroes, should follow the teachings of Mao Zedong?
Yes, they should follow the teachings. Now, because of the fact that Chairman Mao says himself that in every situation that the people must determine what they can use and what they can't use, and that nothing should be forced from the outside, that the people in their respective communities must decide and must fashion the methods that they use. So I suggest that from his own teachings that they follow this. This means that any struggle in the United States need not necessarily be following the blueprint of the Chinese Revolution, even the Chinese philosophy.
Yeah, but don't you realize that by wearing a Mao Zedong pin and by saying that Afro-Americans should follow the teachings of Chairman Mao, that you in fact substantiate the claims by people in the United States that the uprisings, that the burnings of American cities are fomented, organized, and supported by the Red Chinese?
I learned long ago not to be too much influenced and concerned with what people say, especially in a negative way, in this negative vein. There are many people in the United States who say that I'm a kidnapper, but I've never kidnapped anybody. There are some people who say I'm a criminal, but I've never committed any criminal act. So I can't be concerned. Look, I am a refugee. I'm a victim of all kinds of racial oppression, tyranny, and terror in the United States. So why should I be concerned with what they think about me or what they call me? My first concern is liberation. My first concern is justice and freedom. And it makes no difference what they call me. It makes no difference what they think, because in the final analysis, they are going to have to face reality. And the reality is that America is not God, America is not the end of the earth, and it doesn't matter what the Americans think. In the final analysis, the truth will come out, and they're going to have to face it, no matter what it is.
Now, just a minute. Are you admitting, or are you acknowledging that the Red Chinese are supporting, fomenting riots in American cities, and maybe even sending in arms and money to people to destroy America?
The Chinese, as far as I know, and I think I'm closer to them than any other American, and I've never known them to send in any money nor arms to America. That the Chinese support the Afro-Americans morally, and the Chinese have asked what the Afro-Americans want.
Now, this is a pamphlet that you wrote in China, and it's called Listen, Brother, by Robert F. Williams, and is directed at American GIs, at Afro-American GIs fighting in Vietnam. Now, you've used things in it like photographs of American cities, of rioting, of fighting between police and civilians, and also photos which are quite terrible of some of the corpses from, let's say, this one is from the Newark rioting, a man shot 17 times by the police. And you have statements in here referring to black and white Americans saying, both of us together can't beat the Viet Cong. The man, meaning white America, wouldn't have a possible chance with us against him, too.
Well,
I mean, what do you mean by this?
First thing, this pamphlet was written in Peking, but it was printed in New York, the United States of America. Next thing is, those pictures are in there. Yes, they're on display. But I didn't commit those crimes. The black people in America didn't commit those crimes. Those crimes were committed by white America and by white America's running dog cops who murdered innocent people on the streets of America. And if these pictures are so horrible, then how much more horrible and terrifying are the actual acts are visited against our people. And
yeah, but you're asking here for American soldiers to commit treason, to actually turn and fight against their own country.
I'm not asking them to commit treason. I'm asking them to stop betraying humanity. I'm asking them not to commit treason against humanity. Man's first duty is to his brother. Man's first duty is to humanity, not to governments, not to brutal, savage governments and oppressors. This was what the German soldiers said. The German soldiers were obeying the Third Reich, the government of Hitler. So this is no excuse, this thing about treason, to threaten people with treason because they refuse to be brutes, because they refuse to resort to the methods of tyranny. No, this is not asking treason. This is asking humanity.
Yeah, but wait a minute. You're not only asking people not to fight the Viet Cong, you're asking them to take up arms against the U.S. government, to destroy the U.S. government. That's more than just not being involved in brutal acts. You're asking them to commit brutality against their fellow Americans.
That's asking to put an end to tyranny, just like in the colonies of the United States when Britain was visiting tyranny on the colonies. It was not enough just not to serve the crown, but the idea was to stop the crown from oppressing others, to eliminate tyranny from the soil of the colonies. And this is what is being requested here. It's not enough for an Afro-American not to kill Vietnamese, but it is his duty to prevent this war machine from crushing his own people, from crushing his people in the streets of racist America. And the idea is that the black man, if he's going to fight, if he's going to be a soldier, he should fight for the liberation of his own people. He's got no business in Vietnam. And the idea is that he is fighting for his own enemy, for the rights of his enemy to oppress others, to destroy others. But he is not fighting for his right to live as a human being or his mother in the United States of America. And what I'm saying is, if they force him into battle, if they force him to kill, then the people he should kill are those who are oppressing him, and those are the white Americans of the United States.
Now you say all white Americans, everybody with light skin, should be killed? What are you saying?
No, I'm not saying that all white Americans should be killed. But I'm saying that those who are killing and murdering Vietnamese in cold blood, the same as they're murdering and killing black people in the streets of Washington, in the streets of Detroit, in Chicago, in Los Angeles, in San Francisco, I'm saying that they deserve to be killed by black soldiers who have gone to kill others in their name and on their behalf.
But what you're saying, if people listen to what you say and try to do what you say, this will result in the death of millions of people. This will result in the death of most black Americans.
You mean it will result in the death of white people in America? Because our people have been being killed in America with impunity for almost 400 years. We've lost millions of people. In fact, Lord Bertrand Russell has said that more Afro-Americans have been exterminated in the United States than Hitler exterminated Jews in Germany. So when you start talking about losing millions of people, you're not talking about black people, you're talking about white people. And if white people insist on murdering our people and practicing genocide against our people, then they have a right to be murdered. And this becomes our duty to end this.
Yeah, but now, don't you think that being out of the United States for almost 8 years now, that you're a little out of touch with what's been happening? There have been great strides made in civil rights. There have been many bills passed. The work of late Reverend King was essential in these things. And white Americans are trying very hard to try to do something about the situation. There's no genocide being committed. There are no concentration camps or gas chambers. You've been involved in this great cultural revolution in China. Perhaps this has gotten you a little out of touch with the United States today, because I'm sure that there are a great many white Americans that think that what you're saying now is way out.
Out of touch? Is it way out that Reverend King is dead? Who killed Reverend King? Reverend King is dead, so I'm out of touch with reality. It appears to me that conditions have worsened. It appears to me that I'm behind time, that I'm too moderate in the view of this, because here is a pacifist, one of the great followers of Gandhi, a man who advocated love and nonviolence, has been shot down in the streets of racist America and killed like a common street dog. Now, and then I'm supposed to be moderate in my outlook. I'm supposed to be merciful. This is asking more of me as a victim than has been asked of the oppressor.
Well, but you're calling for an attack on hundreds of millions of people based upon the act of one man.
But not a matter of an act of one man. That mankind is responsible for his fellow man. That society is a collective community, and you cannot be aloof in a community where you live. The German people allowed Hitler to lead them down the drain. They allowed Hitler to rage and to act like a maniac, and they didn't take any position whatever. They supported Germany. They supported their government, and as a result of this, we can see what happened. Now, the American people can't hide behind the excuse that they are not doing it, that they are not committing these crimes. But they are absolutely responsible for these crimes, because these crimes are being committed in the name of the American people by a government that states it is a government of the people, for the people, and by the people.
But the American government didn't kill Reverend King, or for that matter Robert Kennedy or President Kennedy.
But it tolerated the death of Martin Luther King. It didn't prevent the death of Martin Luther King. And the 14th Amendment says that every citizen is equal, is entitled to equal protection under law. Now, The J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI says that they know every time some conspiracy is being formulated in the ghetto. They know about plots they claim against leaders like Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young. They know when the statues are going to be blowing up. They know when people are planning to set off bombs. But they didn't know when the President of the United States was about to be killed. They didn't know when Martin Luther King was about to be killed. They didn't know when Bobby Kennedy was about to be killed. Now, what is all of this about? All of this good protection and know-how and protection of people like Roy Wilkins and Whitney Young and these people, and no protection of the Kennedys and the Kings.
Well, do you think that the Kennedys aren't Afro-Americans? They're white Americans.
Yeah, they are white Americans, but they have run afoul of the rightist forces in the United States, the same as Reverend King.
Well, then aren't your enemies certain forces in the United States and not white society as a whole?
There are certain forces in the United States, but the fact is that when you have a community that is becoming degenerate, and that is being overrun by degenerates, and that degeneracy is becoming an order of the day, then no honest man can take an inactive position. No honest man can be neutral. And if honest men are neutral, then they are not neutral, and they are not honest, but they become accessories after the fact and after the act and to the act.
All right, now, you have been in China. You have been given honors and position that no American citizen, practically no private person in the world has ever had. For example, you have been allowed to stand next to Chairman Mao on the Gate of Heavenly Peace, the Capitol building in Peking, and actually take the microphone and speak to 2.5 million people. Why do you think that you as an individual, you Robert Franklin Williams, have been given these honors and this position, this incredible support, at least moral support, if you claim no arms, by the communist government in China?
Because I'm the first black victim of racial oppression and tyranny to have been able to escape this network of tyrants. The first one to land on a friendly soil, or to land on soil where they are opposed to this type of tyranny. So it is only natural that the Chinese people would want to hear what I've got to say. Not only do they want to hear what I've got to say, but they think others in the world who are victims and potential victims of the same injustice, the racist oppression and injustice, that the people who are potentially targets of this should know the nature, the true nature of America.
Now, in China, and I realize it's impossible to discuss this in a short period of time, this would take hours, but in China, you've been living through this great cultural revolution that they're calling it, which has, in many ways, torn Chinese society apart. People in the States don't know much about this. What's going on in China? What are the forces involved? What is this cultural revolution? Can you just say it very simply?
Well, it will actually be impossible for the people in the United States to understand the cultural revolution in China or anything about China, because they don't have enough background to understand what's going on. But actually, basically, what has taken place is that the Chinese youth and the Chinese workers and peasants and soldiers, under the direction and teaching of Chairman Mao, are trying to develop a new society that will mold a new kind of man, a new kind of individual, the type of individual that the Christians claimed they wanted to produce many years ago, and that is that there will be men who will be honest, men who will be devoid of ego, men who will work for the collective good of all, men who will not put their selfish motives ahead of those of their fellow men. And this is basically is what they're trying to do, the objective. Now, there's nothing that says that they are going to succeed. There's no certainty of this. In fact, Mao Zedong himself has said that there's a possibility that they may lose, but this is what they're trying to do. And they're having much trouble and friction because there are some who support socialism, some who support communism, some who support Mao Zedong, but who don't think that they can overcome this feeling of personal gain, that they can overcome ego. And some people are opposed to this because it requires a great deal. You must try to imagine what it requires of a person to think more of humanity, to think more of the people in his community than of himself and his own immediate family.
You mean they're trying to create a society where people won't work to get more pay or won't work to get bonuses? In other words, the whole direction that Russia is going in, this Liebermanism and things like that, is to let workers participate in factory profits. Are you saying that the Chinese are trying to motivate people just by idealism? That certainly would cause a conflict.
Well, as are the people themselves. You see, this is the strange thing about it. It's not the government trying to force the people to accept this philosophy, but many of the people, and especially the peasants themselves and soldiers, are saying that this must be done. This is the type of society they want, and that they are actually striving to produce a type of personality wherein the man's satisfaction for his work will come from the satisfaction of creating for the good of all, for the good of humanity. That he will derive his compensation from the fact that he knows that he is contributing to humanity.
What do you see for the United States? You're an American. You still say you're an American citizen. What do you think is going to happen there in the States?
Well, I think great turmoil is going to take place there. And what we've seen today is just a sample of what is developing in the world, a new attitude that there's much contempt and much hatred for America because of its imperialist attitude, because of its capitalist attitude in dealing with others, because of its racist attitude. And people in the world are beginning to get tired of this. And more they're beginning to complain. And more they're beginning to see the United States as the devil power of the earth. And not only the people outside, but our people inside, the black people, are beginning to see America as serving as the devil to make life miserable for the good people of the world or the struggling peoples. So I can foresee the day when, unless America changes, and unless it changes soon, it is going to be completely destroyed. It's going to be wiped off the first face of the earth, because it is impossible for a nation to serve the devil and to do such evil to others and exist. And it was Abraham Lincoln himself who said that a nation divided among itself cannot stand, and America is divided.
Now, but when you say wiped off the face of the earth, there's no power on earth that will dare to attack us, or we can destroy Russia or China or anybody else who tries this. What are you talking about when you say wiped off the face of the earth?
Well, when I say wiped off the face of the earth, I mean that part of it is going to come from within America. America is already about to destroy itself. America now is in such a sorry state that even the President of the United States is not safe, unless he's a rightist, that a man who was Attorney General, a man who was an aspirant for the presidency, can be killed openly in the streets.
But that's not the destruction of the United States.
No, but this is the beginning. This shows that there's something seriously wrong, and this shows that the society is becoming so degenerate and so many explosions are taking place among the people that it can't possibly stand, plus the fact it's suffering defeat in Vietnam, and more that the peoples of the world are beginning to resist, and they're going to resist more. And all of these forces brought together, including the degeneracy inside the country, is going to bring about its destruction. That's all it is to it.
Yeah, but you're talking the abstract here. In your newsletter, in your radio broadcast in the past, and in many statements that you've made, you've been quite specific. You've said that Afro-Americans are going to blow up American factories, dynamite Hoover Dam, destroy the railroad lines, destroy electrical power lines. You tell how to make Molotov cocktails, how to attack the police. Aren't you, in fact, advocating, preaching that Afro-Americans should try to destroy American industry and bring chaos to American cities?
I'm preaching for my people the same thing that George Washington and Patrick Henry preached for their people in another time, in another day, that I'm preaching that we must use any means necessary in order to liberate ourselves, and that we have no right to submit to tyranny. I'm saying that we must become men, and we must resist, and we must use any means, no matter what it requires. And the fact that I'm more concerned with the liberation of people, I'm more concerned with humanity and the human flesh than with buildings, than with the loss of property. You see, this is a cold capitalist version of the fact that we must save the property. But I'm interested in saving the people, and the black people have a right to be saved as much as anybody. And unless white America is willing to liberate the black people and to stop oppressing us, then if America must go up in smoke, then let it go, let it go, let it burn.
creating buses in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. And that was our Black August segment for today, Saturday, August 22nd, 2021. We're going to be winding down our program. If you'd like to have access to this program, just go to the Pan-African Radio Network at blogtalkradio.com/Pan-African Journal. If you want to read the Pan-African Newswire, just go to panafricannews.blogspot.com. We'll be closing out with Abby Lincoln and Straight Ahead from 1961. This is Abayomi Azikiwe signing off, and have a beautiful week.
You've got to use the straight ahead can lead nowhere. On this road you got a problem getting where you want to go. Speed limit's almost down to nothing. Straight ahead, but oh, Miss Lucy, put that music book away. What's the use of keep on trying if you practice till you're gray? You can't start no notes of flying like the ones that rant and ring from the kitchen to the big woods when Melinda sings. Easy enough for folks to holler, looking at the lines and dots, but they ain't no one can sense it, and the tune comes in spots. But for real melodic music that just strikes your heart and cling, just stand and listen with me when Melinda sings. Oh, it's sweeter than the music of an educated band, and it's dearer than the battle songs of triumph in the land. It seems holier than evening when those silent church bells ring, as I sit and calmly listen when Melinda sings.
Thank you.